The 100 Years' War, the Duguesclin period. The English capture Brest in 1377. The Earl of Buckingham had originally planned to sail to Brest with the annual wine convoy that would be bound for Gascony, which usually left in early October. Well, he missed the convoy, which sailed without him, taking some of his troops and most of his ships with him. As a result, the Earl was forced to postpone his expedition until the end of the year. He decided to make use of the ships and troops still waiting in London by taking them on a plundering raid against the Flemish port of Sluys, where a large number of Castilian merchant ships were reportedly to be waiting, laden with cargo for a favorable wind. Since the English government was endeavoring to maintain good relations with the Count of Flanders and his subjects, this was not a wise decision, and it is quite possible that Buckingham consulted no one but his fellow captains. In the event, they never reached Sluys. In the last week of October, Buckingham and his companions mustered their men outside the half-finished buildings of Edward III's Cistercian foundation of St. Mary Grace's, east of the Tower of London, and further down the Thames at Ratcliffe, a bleak area of wharfs and boatyards in the Shepney Marsh. These men were crammed in the 30 large warships and a number of smaller barges and supply vessels. They put to sea on November the 7th, 1377. After 3 days, they encountered a terrible storm. Driving rain and gale-force winds scattered a fleet. Several of the supply ships took water and were abandoned by their crews, who took refuge on the crowded decks of the warships. The survivors limped home with broken masts and torn sails. The fiasco was rather unfairly blamed on the two admirals, both of whom were removed at the beginning of December after only a few months in office. They were replaced by the Earls of Arundel and the Earl of Warwick, who were expected to bring more energy to their task. Buckingham's fleet was repaired and reunited at Sandwich in the course of the following month and sailed again in the middle of December 1377. Shortly afterwards, it successfully joined forces with the Western fleet in the Channel. The combined armada then headed south for Brest, between 60 and 80 strong. The ships must have reached the town about Christmas time. They found the approach to the harbor blocked by the Castilian squadron lying off the town. Seeing the great carax ahead of them, a large part of the English fleet mutinied and refused to fight. One of Buckingham's subordinate commanders was threatened with death by his crew unless he agreed to turn back. Undeterred, Buckingham sailed ahead with the rest of his ships and broke through the enemy line. 8 armed Castilian merchants were captured in this fight and a number of others put to flight. When Buckingham and his companions entered the harbor, they encountered opposition of a most unexpected kind. The garrison in the castle consisted mainly of Englishmen, commanded by a former associate of Robert Knowles, called John Lakenheath. They were in an unusually ugly humor. They claimed to be owed more than 22,000 francs, about 3,700 pounds, in back wages, and refused to open their gates unless it was paid. The leaders of the army had to guarantee this sum personally before they were allowed to take possession. Once inside, Buckingham appointed Robert Knowles as temporary captain. He filled the stores of the castle with supplies, which he brought with him. He increased the garrison's strength. He began to push out the limits of the garrison's effective control in the Finistère region. The new base was swiftly turned into a center for English commerce raiding. Cargoes were commandeered from passing ships to add to the garrison's stores. Making north into the channel with a galley and 2 barges, Sir Thomas Percy was able to disperse a convoy of 50 unarmed Flemish and Castilian merchantmen, sinking several of them and capturing at least 2 entire cargoes. This short campaign was one of the most successful naval enterprises of the English since 1369. On January the 25th, 1378, the fleet returned in triumph to England. Brest was destined to remain in English hands for over 20 years. It never did serve as a point of entry into France, though. The sea journey always proved to be too long for the carriage of a large army. The fortress played a modest part in supporting English naval operations in the Channel and maintaining communications with Gascony. The fortress, like Calais, it became a largely military town, economically dependent on its garrison, and Knowles held the town and castle with 240 men, and the garrison was probably maintained at something like that level until the end of the 1380s. The local civilian population was progressively driven out by the hardships of frequent French raids and sieges, and persistent requisitioning and billeting by its English captains. Food and supplies proved to be a major problem. Managed by the king's receiver, a full-time official, and a network of suppliers at Dartmouth, Foney, Bayonne, and Bordeaux, the regular works had to be carried out on the walls and towers. Gunpowder artillery was manufactured in England and laboriously hauled to the coast to be shipped out to the town. At least two ships were kept permanently in the harbor to maintain communications with the mainland and capture prizes at sea. Whether all of this justified the expense may be in doubt. In the first few years, the net cost of the English occupation at Brest was between 6,000 and 8,000 pounds a year, which was substantially more than the English government spent on Gascony over the same period. The main beneficiaries of the occupation of Brest were its captains. Much of the seaborne commerce of Western Europe was carried past the fortress, and it offered rich spoils. Inland garrisons gradually established a ransom district extending north to the coast and south as far as the Bay of Bénédict. Noel's successors as captain was of Brest, who relieved him in June of 1378, were two Oxfordshire knights close to the king, Sir Richard Aberbury and Sir John Gallifrey. These men, neighbors at home, had probably entered into a partnership to exploit the profits of the war together. They entered into a fixed price contract with the king, under which they agreed to man and defend the fortress at their own expense in return for an annual fee of 10,000 marks, that's 6,667 pounds, plus a portion of the spoil, which was calculated according to a complicated formula, leaving them with about half. During the 11-month tenure of the fortress by Aberbury and Gallifrey, the spoil declared to the king's receiver came to 1,727 pounds, of which rather more than half was derived from pates, and that is forcing people to pay for security, and the rest came from ships and cargoes captured at sea. Of this sum, 875 pounds went into the captain's pockets, a considerable fortune by the standards of the time. Aberbury and Gallifrey were followed by another business partnership of Sir Hugh Caverley and Sir Thomas Percy, who took the contract at a slightly reduced fee with a larger share of the spoil. They were all essentially financial transactions. The captains of Brest rarely visited the fortress and generally performed their duties through deputies who accounted to them for the profits. Caverley and Percy declared less than half of the spoil of their predecessor that they had done, but made more in the end. In 1384, when Percy held the contract alone, the Bretons claimed that the garrison was taking protection money of 160 parishes and reckoned the proceeds at 35,000 francs. That's 5,800 pounds a year. That's cash. And 1,200 barrels of fish, meat, and grain. There is no record of the cost incurred by the early captains of Brest, but the fact that the government was able to drive a much harder bargain with their successors suggests that they did very well for themselves. Richard Aberbury, who was already a rich man when he went to Brest, but it's not fanciful to see the grand gatehouse of the Castle Dunnington in Berkshire, which is ostensibly rebuilt for him in the 1380s as a monument to the profits of a successful war contract, even in a time when English fortunes were actually on the waning. Next time we'll see what's going to happen in Brest and what the French are going to end up doing. Now the sources for this, The Hundred Years' War, The Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and The Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.